Now, switching gears to small cell lung cancer, we had Dr. David Spiegel present his plenary session and just kind of set the table there. Patients, even though we still stage them, you know, most general oncologists do limited stage and extensive stage. So, you know, limited stage, you do platinum doublet, cisplatin preferred, ideally. And then maybe double dose radiation therapy, BID dosing radiation. And then the question is, before we get into that data, is there seems to be some controversy now, because I know you're on the NCCN guidelines for small cell for limited stage. We're moving away from prophylactic cranial radiation. What are your thoughts about that in your practice?
Yeah, let's start with the PCI question. And I will just say, as an institution, we're kind of biased towards moving away from PCI. I think there's other oncologists, if you talk like that, different institutions might have different practice patterns. I think part of the reason we're moving away from it is if you look at some of the original data for prophylactic cranial radiation, ERTC study was actually the one that really got this on the map. It was a Dutch study that looked at prophylactic cranial radiation. And it did show that there was a reduction in intracranial recurrence in patients who had prophylactic cranial radiation. I think the devil is in the details. So one of the things that was criticized with that study was that patients weren't required to have surveillance MRIs after their prophylactic cranial radiation. In fact, CNS imaging was really only obtained after they had neurologic symptoms. So a Japanese group subsequently looked at this and addressed this question with randomizing patients, a very well done study, looking at MRI surveillance versus PCI. In this study specifically, all patients got serial MRIs on the surveillance arm. And it's true that there is a lower rate of intracranial progression events with the patients who got prophylactic cranial irradiation. However, it didn't really translate to any overall survival difference. And so I think one of the critiques about the ERTC data is that that was done in an era when the ability to offer high quality SRS was not as good, and the ability to just get surveillance MRIs at a regular interval was not as readily available. So I think if your institution has the ability to do that, well, first I would say this involves a conversation with the patient, because I think they should really know and hear both where the data is currently. I will mention that the ongoing SWOG MAVERICK study will hopefully answer this question in a really definitive way, and that's a study that's still ongoing and we await the results of that data. So yes, that's the PCI conversation. And certainly the data was best for limited stage versus extensive stage. But in this study, we used typically, as you pointed out, cisplatin, etoposide as a backbone, although sometimes we'll substitute carboplatin based on what we perceive as medical fitness. And then the radiotherapy regimen can either be the definitive course or you could do a hypofractionated course as well. What the Adriatic trial address, which is, I think, a really important and landmark study, was looking at limited stage small cell. But historically, after we did chemo radiotherapy, we would just observe these patients. There was no study that looked at the role of introducing a consolidation immune checkpoint inhibitor. And this study addressed that with three arms. There was a concurrent chemo radiotherapy arm. There was a concurrent chemo radiotherapy arm followed by durvalumab for a maximum of 24 months, or concurrent chemo radiotherapy with durvalumab plus tremelimumab, which is their CTLA-4 inhibitor, also for 24 months. The data that was presented was really the concurrent chemo radiotherapy durvalumab versus observation data. There it was very clear there was an overall survival benefit. So the patients who got durvalumab had an OS of 59.9 months versus those that didn't. It was 33.4 months, a hazard ratio of 0.73. When I looked at the data, I thought the radiation regimens they used were reasonable. The use of cisplatin chemotherapy between both groups were comparable. So there wasn't this imbalance where the observation group was getting more carboplatin. I thought that was actually pretty well balanced. To me, this really just represents a new standard of care. At this point, this is a study we've been wanting to do. I've long lamented that I've not been able to give our limited stage small cell lung cancer patients the opportunity to have immune checkpoint inhibitors. Some of us have, you know, justified it saying they were kind of bulky, maybe they might have been metastatic, and so we did upfront chemo IO. But I think this study really now just shows treat these patients with chemo radiation, add the durvalumab. To me, the challenge moving forward is what do we do when these patients have metastatic relapse? And do we now use the same definitions of platinum sensitive? So if they relapse within 3 months or within 6 months, do we re-challenge them with, you know, the Empower 133 regimen or the Caspian regimen using, you know, atezolizumab or durvalumab? Or, and this is, I think, where things can get a little bit more interesting, do we start to think about novel immune therapies like T-cell bispecifics, such as what we've seen the FDA just recently approve in the second line setting?
Absolutely. Yeah, a lot of great questions. But, you know, this is something that we needed. It just, I mean, small cell, we really haven't had that much data. And you know, I agree with you, like in terms of the PCI, you definitely have to get a brain MRI with contrast if you elect to not do, you know, any kind of PCI treatment, because that's what the NCCN guidelines are that we all kind of follow. And then in terms of the limited stage, I think the one big difference here is when everybody's used to this non-small cell, kind of very like the Pacific study, it's 1 year of immunotherapy, but this is 2 years. And so you're capturing some of these patients as well. And then also, I thought it was kind of interesting with some of the updates in the NCCN guidelines for small cell. If a patient received previous TKI, because you tend to have more, I guess, mixed small cell in the limited stage. So does that mean if they have like an EGFR or some other medication in the past that received a TKI? Because you've seen that, Tejas, you get a lot of these referrals from tertiary, because you're in the tertiary center. It's not 100% pure small cell. So any advice on that?
Yeah, that's tricky. These are the hard cases when you get the mixed histology. So when you get mixed histology, my general recommendation is to treat the small cell component. Cisotopicide is a sensitizing regimen with radiotherapy, even in non-small cell. It's true that the dosing is a little bit different for the non-small cell concurrent regimen than the small cell. But in my view, it's an active agent nonetheless. And so if you're faced with this scenario where you have a stage 3 patient and they would otherwise be limited stage, but one node shows adenocarcinoma, the other node shows small cell, what do you do? I would treat it as small cell, and then I would also offer durvalumab. I think the really hard question is if that adenocarcinoma component shows EGFR, what do you do there? Do you do the LORA approach or do you do an immunotherapy approach for the small cell? I haven't, thankfully, I've not encountered that clinical question yet. I think it would be really hard. I'd have to talk to the patient. My instinct tells me to treat the small cell, which I think has a much higher likelihood of relapse. So I would probably offer that patient some kind of immune checkpoint inhibitor. But that's a really difficult, tricky question.
Yeah, that's why we send all the tough cases to you, my man, because that way, because you're always up to the data, and then you can kind of tease out what's best for our patients, you know. But going back, you know, in terms of the extensive stage 4, I found it kind of interesting. You know, there's always little nuances that's always kind of new. And so, you know, whenever we treated with small cell, and this was before the immune therapy era, we had cisplatin sensitivity, cisplatin resistant. So it was always at that 6 months. But then there's been an update here around 3 to 6 months. It says, consider rechallenging with platinum, which goes back to what you were saying with immunotherapy, Tejas. Has there been like data there where that's now that 3 to 6 months you can rechallenge with platinum?
But it's a murky space, and the platinum rechallenge data is always a little bit difficult to interpret. My general threshold, I don't really use 3 months. I actually use 6 months as a cutoff. I find that 3 months, in all practicality, 3 months, it means 4 cycles of treatment, which really means your first scan. If your first scan shows a response, but then 3 months later they're progressing, are they really sensitive? It's hard to conceptually think of it like that, for me at least. So I tend to use a more stricter cutoff of 6 months. You know, I mean, we get responses with platinum rechallenges. It's just they're not as durable as first line. And I think now with the incorporation of DLL3 bispecific T-cell engagers, that's really going to be a new paradigm where I think those are the opportunities that we can get those patients, instead of just doing a platinum rechallenge, maybe we can offer them a new form of immunotherapy that leads to more durable responses.
Yeah. You know, sometimes when you have something new like this, that's revolutionary, bispecific T-cell engagers for solid tumors. And so now the floodgates are going to open up, right? Now we're going to have to start building relationships with our BMT doctors, because now you're thinking about the toxicities of these bispecific T-cell engagers, because it's FDA approved now. And so is this something that you guys have kind of started doing already, Tejas? You guys are already the leader in the field there at University of Colorado. How do you incorporate this FDA approved bispecific T-cell engagers for these small cells where there's activity for cisplatin sensitivity and resistant? There's data on both sides. Yeah. How do you guys have been to prepare for this?
Yeah, it's a good question. So first of all, we have a DLL T cell bispecific trial. So that's ongoing. But outside of the trial, just using the FDA approved label, we're building the plan as we speak. I think this is going to be an organizational challenge because I do wonder whether the model will be very similar to what we have established with our heme colleagues who treat patients with multiple myeloma and some of the hematologic malignancies, where community oncologists may refer patients to a large center like ours, where we can deliver the bispecific, at least for the first several doses, ensure there's no evidence of CRS, and then if that looks okay, return them back to the community. And then for patients who are really rural, I am not sure how to implement this type of therapy. I mean, it's going to require some serious coordination with their hospitals, resources, familiarity with monitoring. So right now, my anticipation, my prediction would be that these patients do get referred to larger centers that have run these cellular therapy studies, have familiarity with the monitoring, know when to give tocilizumab if there's concern that patients are worsening cytokine release syndrome or having worsening ICANS scores. And then one thing that has been reassuring about this type of treatment is that it seems to be the risk of those side effects are typically early and usually within the first 3 to 4 doses. And so there is a model where we can maybe do the first several doses here and then have the patient go back to their community oncologist and get treated there.
Yeah, great valid points. You know, just as a reminder to our audience here, you know, metastatic small cell, chemoimmunotherapy, you carboplatin, that's atezolizumab. You could also do cisplatin, but, you know, durvalumab. I guess durvalumab, you got the cisplatin and the carboplatin. So you can go one way or the other. And then if it's hard to kind of get a hold of somebody for this bispecific T-cell engager, we still have lubrinectin. You know, Tejas, what are your thoughts about lubrinectin? I mean, this is approved for preferred for patients that are cisplatin resistant, i.e. less than 6 months, but you're one of the experts. Any guidance on this treatment and what toxicities, any advice on this?
Yeah, lurbinectedin is an interesting drug. It's one of the few drugs I know that is approved based on a negative phase 3 study. So there was a phase 3 study where lurbinectedin was compared to either CAV or topotecan. This was the Atlantis study, and it was negative. But that being said, you know, the standard of care, quote unquote standard, is still topotecan. However, I will say most oncologists, and myself included, don't like giving topotecan.
Five days in a row.
It's cumbersome. It's extraordinarily myelosuppressive. And when you actually go back and look at the topotecan data, one of the original trials actually was compared to best supportive care. And then the other one was an equivalency study to a CAB. And so it's not like topotecan is standing on high ground. It was always sort of ripe for displacement, especially if the drug with a better adverse event profile came through. So I think lurbinectedin does offer that opportunity. It is a treatment that has reasonable activity in small cell lung cancer. Some limitations with lurbinectedin. Myelosuppression is a big problem with this treatment. The other one is it has not the best CNS efficacy or CNS data. And so I think especially if you're having patients that are having intracranial progression or intracranial and extracranial progression after platinum etoposide and an immune checkpoint inhibitor, I think it's reasonable at that point to have the conversation about either doing whole brain or doing SRS or some kind. And then if you're going to use lurbinectedin, then you really need to watch the CNS closely.
Just kind of going over the highlights there. You know, we discussed limited stage small cell. The main remaining question now is if they progress, you know, do we get the immunotherapy, continue with the immunotherapy in a metastatic? Unresolved question. This is something I think all the, you know, leaders in the field like yourself will have to kind of help us on. And then once you progress on, you know, extensive stage, the question is the bispecific T-cell engager. This is so new. So all these different big organizations going to define a plan to kind of get these patients treated, because just talking to a lot of the BMT doctors in terms of the curbside, they're not interested in small cell. They are not interested. So it's going to require like a team effort. Any lasting thoughts for small cell?
I think small cell has had one of the first exciting developments in decades, the Adriatic study. And I will also mention that the class of drugs, the DLL3 T-cell bispecifics, I think they represent a real treatment advance. And I think moving forward, the question is going to be, how do we operationalize that? I think there's going to be a lot of organizational logistics that go in delivering these treatments that are not straightforward. And I will also say there's probably not going to be a one-size-fits-all for each organization. I think different communities are going to have different practice patterns in terms of how they do it, the arrangements they work out with their hospital centers or their infusion centers to deliver this type of treatment. So I think there you'll start to see different models, which could be very interesting. I think we could learn a lot from each other.